Thanks to the organizers, of course. It's really a great privilege to speak here. So today I'm going to talk about some joint work, so things that I've done together with Samson, who you saw speak earlier, and with Rui Soares Barbosa, who unfortunately couldn't be here this week, but he was around last week, so some of you may have met him. So to give you an overview of what I'd like to say, so I think we'll probably all accept the first point that contextuality is somehow a fundamental non-classical phenomenon. In recent times, it's been increasingly studied as a resource for quantum computing and information processing. So to give some examples, non-local games are the more general kinds of things that Samson would have mentioned earlier. And then certain kinds of measurement-based quantum computing schemes, or even magic quantum computing via magic state distillation. And what I'm talking about today, or what I want to introduce, is a measure of contextuality called the contextual fraction. And it gives a quantitative measure which has many desirable properties. So it's general, it applies in any measurement scenario. We can relate it to Bell inequalities, so we can relate this precisely to violations of Bell inequalities. It's computable using linear programming. In fact, both the contextual fraction and the witnessing inequality are computable. And finally, it's monotone with respect to operations that don't, which intuitively you should expect will not introduce contextuality. And so in thinking about these operations, we actually get a sort of a basic kind of a resource theory for contextuality. And it's also interesting to say that we can use it for something. So it does relate to quantifiable advantages in certain tasks. And so I'll say a few things about this as well. So just the plan of the talk, I will go over the formalism I'm going to use to begin with. This will probably recap things that you've seen in Samson's talk. I'll go through these quickly, but I think it's probably no harm to see some things again just to refresh your memory. I'll tell you some things about the kinds of computational explorations we can do, so since we can efficiently compute these things. And then I'll mention things about the resource theory and quantum advantages. Okay, so the first step here is to understand how to treat empirical data. So the idea is very much that contextuality is going to be looked at as a feature of the empirical data. And so the kinds of empirical data that we tend to come across are things like what we see in this slide. So here is a very basic experimental protocol. A preparation is being made. Something's been sent to Alice and something has been sent to Bob. Alice chooses to make a measurement, A1 or A2, and gets an outcome, 0 or 1. And same thing for Bob. His measurements are B1 and B2. And if we use quantum theory to predict how this should behave, or if we go into the laboratory and actually repeat this experiment many times to build up frequencies of what we observe, we end up getting, or we would end up getting, a probability table that would look something like this. And so what the probability table says, I mean, it just so you understand how to read this, it says that if Alice makes the A1 measurement and Bob makes the B1 measurement, then there's probability 1/2 that they both obtain outcome 0, for instance. So this is how we read the table. All right, now we want to understand how to formalize this kind of data. So the first thing is to treat the measurement scenario itself. So this is the information about the kind of experiment that we're doing. And essentially this comes from the shape of the table somehow. So we could get different kinds of data appearing for an experiment of the same kind. Okay, so there are three elements here. The first is a set of measurements. In this case, the measurements are two measurements for Alice and two measurements for Bob. I see I've done something with primes and subscripts, but hopefully you can get the idea. So it always happens. Always miss something somewhere. Okay, the next aspect is that we want to know about compatibilities. So these are the contexts. So these are subsets of X which cover X and which tell us which observables can be jointly observed, which measurements can be jointly observed. Okay, so if you like, we could represent this in a sort of compatibility graph or hypergraph or simplicial complex ultimately. And then finally, we're going to have a set of outcomes, so telling us the values that these observables could take. So this is how we formalize a measurement scenario. It's how we treat the kind of measurement that we're doing. So just to give you another example, here is a different sort of measurement scenario, the triangle measurement scenario. It's got a different set of measurements. Again, we have these pairwise contexts, and we have just a binary set of outcomes, for instance. And you see I've started to build these little bundle diagrams like you've seen from Samson's talk earlier, so I could formalize these, but I won't go into the details. It just gives a nice visual tool. So these are the measurements, the compatibilities, and the fibers above tell me the values that those measurements could take. Okay, and here's yet another one, just to show you that this is somehow versatile. So this is the kind of measurement scenario from the 18 vector proof of Cauchy-Becker. And so here it starts to get a little bit more complicated. It's harder to draw the bundle diagrams. I took the compatibility graph here. This is Ravi's drawing. So thank you to Ravi for allowing me to use this. Maybe it just gives you another way of visualizing the context here. But the point is, it's a completely general way to talk about experiments. So these triples are very broadly applicable. Okay, so that's the measurement scenario, but what about the empirical data? So this is what we're going to call an empirical model. So it's a way of filling in this table. Essentially, it's assigning probabilities to these edges in the bundle diagram, if you like to see it that way. And so what we have is a family of probability distributions. There's one for each context. And we have some sort of local consistency. So it says that where contexts overlap, the marginal probabilities are well-defined. They agree with each other. Okay, so this is a generalized version of no signaling. If we're dealing with bell-type measurement scenarios, it's exactly no signaling. In general, it will hold for quantum data, even when it's not coming from a bell scenario, and it gives a generalized notion of no signaling. Okay. All right, so that's how we represent the data. Now, what about classical data? So what do we expect from classical data? Well, one thing that we could say is that we expect that preparations at the time of preparation were really setting a global assignment of outcomes to all of the measurements that we could eventually make. So that there's some sort of instruction set for whatever we go on to measure. We just check this instruction set and return those outcomes. So that's one way, that's like deterministic global assignments. In fact, this is equivalent, so the existence of a distribution over global assignments would be equivalent to the existence of factorizable hidden variables, which is why in the case of Bell models, we get the usual notion of Bell locality here. All right, so that's what we expect of classical data. And now, let's try to visualize how this should work and how it can break down. So classical data should arise as convex combinations of global assignments, right? What are global assignments? It's basically just evaluation. So it tells me what the outcome would be for every one of these measurements. So here's everything goes to zero, here's everything goes to one, and then you have everything in between. And how we see this in the table and in the diagram, so in the table, everything goes to zero would look like this, deterministic values. And in the diagram, it looks like this. All right, So the classical data is built up as convex combinations of these things, okay? So I'm allowed to build convex combinations of these closed loops, these univocal paths, if you like. All right, but, so things like this would be allowed with appropriate probabilities attached to the edges, so halves here in the table. But of course, some tables, so this is the table for the PR box, some tables cannot be obtained as convex combinations of global assignments. And actually, you can read this directly off in the diagram. So there is no closed path, there's no univocal path that we could find in here. All right. So this is when we cannot recover the data from convex combinations of these global assignments, we are contextual. All right. So I wasn't going to include this slide, but then since there was mention of simplicial complexes this morning, I thought maybe it was worth putting it in because it's nice to draw connections. So basically, the measurement scenario, we can think of it as giving us a simplicial complex, which is going to be defined by the set of measurements and the context. If we really want to think of a simplicial complex, we're going to have to think of subsets of the maximal context when we go to this, but we can always obtain empirical data just by marginalization for those. All right, and if you want to think about how this looks visually in relation to the simplicial complexes, what's going on is the empirical model, it gives us a probability distribution for each face. So here for each of the edges, or in this case for each of the triangular faces. And we have well-defined marginals, so whatever information we have on this edge and this edge marginalizes correctly to give me something that agrees on B. And if we can extend this to a, so we have all these local distributions, if you like, and if we can extend these to, somehow extend these to a global distribution, we would be classical, and if we can't, we would be contextual. So it's a way of kind of seeing it somehow in this topological setting. Actually, here's a nice analogy that I always like to present. So you may see what's about to happen. So you're assigning data locally to in context. We have some sort of local compatibility. So if we take these two contexts where they overlap, or it seems that we can glue these together and everything would be fine. Same with these two, same with these two. But somehow if we try to put them all together, we end up with an impossible geometric figure. All right, so it's kind of a good analogy for what's happening with contextuality. In fact, it's an analogy that can be made a bit more formal. So Samson also mentioned this tri-bar. So Penrose, for instance, considered these impossible figures in constructive geometry and used cohomological tools very similar to what we use to analyze contextuality. All right. And now there's another concept that I'm going to briefly recap because it's important for what I want to say, and that's the notion of strong contextuality. So just to recall, strong contextuality is when no global assignment of outcomes to measurements is consistent with the data that we observe. And this is an easy example, this PR box, so we can clearly see that I can't get one of those global assignments or closed univocal paths. Okay, so examples are Cauchy's Becker models, GHZ, the PR box, all AVN models. If you want to find out more about AVN models, check Giovanni's poster, for instance. Okay, so now what about this contextual fraction? So we said what it means to be contextual, and how do we find out about how contextual the data is? So the first step is to phrase what's happening as a linear system. And so this is a way of thinking about the problem that actually appeared in the paper by Abramsky and Brandenberger. So what we do is we take the empirical data, we flatten it out to a vector, so it's going to be a real vector, and we can do the same kind of thing for the global assignments, right? So global assignments are also going to be vectors. They're going to have ones because they're going to be deterministic in each context. So there's going to be a whole list of these global assignments, and we create this matrix which just has global assignments as columns. All right, and now we can phrase the problem of trying to decide if this data is contextual or not as a linear problem. We're just looking for a solution to this system of equations. All right, so it's basically saying a distribution over global assignments which recovers the empirical data that we have in the table that we began with. All right. Okay. So that's how we would check if it is contextual or not. Now the question is how much of the data can be explained classically. So the non-contextual fraction of the data, first of all, that's going to be the maximum weight we can assign to a lambda in such decompositions, right? So the idea is I want to decompose the data that I'm looking at into some part that's non-contextual and some part that possibly is. It turns out that if I find the maximum lambda, then the model that's left over is necessarily strongly contextual. So this is easy to prove. All right, so we call this maximum lambda the non-contextual fraction, and then similarly, of course, we're just going to define the contextual fraction, the sort of irreducibly contextual part, to be 1 minus that. Okay. So straight up, we can just see that it has some nice properties, right? So it's a number between 0 and 1, so it's normalized. 0 tells us that E is non-contextual. And 1 tells us that it is strongly contextual. So we have this quantitative grading between non-contextual on the one hand and strongly contextual on the other. All right. So let's see this via linear programming. So the checking of non-contextuality is simply solving this problem. We're trying to find this distribution D that's going to recover, so a distribution over, remember this M encodes the global assignments that recovers the empirical data we want. And now we can compute the non-contextual fraction as solving this linear program. So what we want to do is we want to find a sub, so this time it's going to be a sub-probability distribution that explains as much of the data as possible. So C is not necessarily going to sum to 1. That's why it's a sub-probability distribution. Okay. All right. And doing this corresponds exactly to finding this maximum lambda from the previous slide. Okay. So just since we have these two programs and they're easy to implement, let me just tell you some things about how we can use this to do some computational explorations. So we've been able to implement tools to calculate, for instance, whatever the empirical model is, so these tables of data from the quantum description. So you give me your state density matrix, if you like, and you give me some quantum observables that you want to perform, I can find the table. Alternatively, you can just give me a table that you dream up, and we can start from there. And then you can use these linear programs to calculate the degree of contextuality of the data you're looking at and to compute the Bell inequality with maximal violation. So I'll show you how we get to this Bell inequality in a slide that's coming up. But here, let me just show you how it looks for computing the degree of contextuality of some families of models. So what we have here is GHZ state, so GHZ state on 3 qubits in this diagram and 4 qubits in this diagram. And what I'm doing is I'm allowing measurements, equatorial measurements at phi 1 and phi 2 on each of the qubits. So I'm just varying the equatorial measurements I'm making on each of them. And I'm able to see how the contextuality evolves through here. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that you can play with these computational tools. So let's come to Bell inequality violations, because this is another way that we have of measuring non-locality, and then we have these contextuality inequalities, which are just a generalized form for measuring contextuality. And it would be nice if this related, and in fact it does. So First, let's just say what we mean by a Bell inequality or a generalized Bell inequality. So for a given scenario, an inequality is just going to be a vector and a bound. And what we're going to do is we're going to take the inner product of this vector with the empirical data, and the inequality should look like this. All right. Without loss of generality, we can always make a transformation to get R non-negative or even zero if we want. So it's convenient to work with R equals zero. And such an inequality is a Bell inequality, we say, if it's got to be satisfied by every non-contextual model. So in other words, it gives a bound on this Bell quantity over non-contextual models. And we say that the Bell inequality is tight if there is some non-contextual model which actually comes up to the bound, which actually hits it. Okay. All right. So if we want to be able to compare contextual fraction and violations of Bell inequalities, we'd better normalize the thing. So there is an algebraic limit, which we can define in this way. So these are the sections in each context. So it's basically going to take the maximum entry in lambda per context and sum those. And we define the normalized violation of Bell inequality just by appropriately taking account of this algebraic maximum. Okay, so then we have this proposition. The violation, so for a given set of empirical data, its violation of any Bell inequality is at most the contextual fraction. Moreover, there exists a Bell inequality for which that violation is attained, and the Bell inequality is tight at the non-contextual model we get in this decomposition. Okay. All right. So we can also kind of try to picture what's happening with the linear programs here. So first of all, for quantifying contextuality, we're trying to basically find the maximum lambda over these decompositions. All right. So in a sense, we're trying to decompose whatever the data we have is into something that's non-contextual and something that's strongly contextual, giving the maximum weight to the non-contextual part. Okay. Now, in linear programming, there is a duality theorem. So given a linear program, we can also look at its dual. And there are some properties that connect the primal and dual. So this is what the dual is, and actually it does something quite interesting for us. It's easier to see what it does if we make a little change of variables. So here I'm just defining a change of variables. This is the number of contexts that we have. So under this change of variables, this is what the dual does. And if we kind of look through this, essentially what it's doing is giving us a Bell inequality. So it's giving us a vector A. The bound for the inequality is going to be zero. This constraint says that for all of the non-contextual models, this is satisfied. And we're trying to maximize the Bell inequality or the Bell quantity. Okay. So this is essentially just calculating for us the equation of a separating hyperplane, or a Bell inequality. Okay. All right. So that's some things about the linear programming, the computational part. Now I would also like to say something about moving towards a resource theory and how this measure of contextuality behaves under operations. So we could observe that there, I mean, maybe some of you are thinking this in your minds, well, there are many possible measures of contextuality, so what makes this the best one to consider, or what makes this a good one to consider? So you can ask, like, what are properties that a good measure should satisfy? And there are some answers that you can kind of propose pretty easily. One is that we should have monotonicity with respect to operations that shouldn't introduce contextuality, all right? And this is kind of moving towards, already, if we can find these operations, it's kind of moving towards the sort of resource theories that we have, like entanglement under Locke. Of course, thermodynamics is a resource theory par excellence as well. So it's kind of moving in that direction. So that's one thing that we would like. Another thing that we might like is that we'd be able to associate this measure of contextuality with the degree of advantage that we get, so quantum advantage over classical, in quantum computation or in information processing tasks. All right. So here are some operations that we can think of. They're very simple things, but I think you'd agree they probably shouldn't introduce contextuality. The first kind of one is just relabeling. So we can talk about relabeling of outcomes. This is a restriction, so it's basically saying that we're going to ignore some of the data coming from some measurements. So we start with a table of empirical data, and now we're restricting ourselves to a subtable, if you like. We can have coarse grainings, so we might want to identify some, for instance, we might identify some of the measurements, some of the measurement settings, or some of the outcomes. We can mix empirical models together, so just probabilistically, it could be this data, or it could be this data with some mixing factor lambda. And then we have some other, so that's the first of the kind of combining operations. Here's another one, choice. So basically I have two different empirical models and I could choose to measure a context from one or to measure a context from the other. Again, we kind of expect that this shouldn't introduce contextuality. Finally, there is a notion of tensor. I won't give the definition now, but I can say something about it afterwards if anyone is curious. And the point is that under all of these operations, we get monotonicity properties. So here in the first case, we find the contextual fraction is invariant. Here we find that it's decreasing monotonically. Same here. For mixing, we get this. For choice, we get this. For tensor, we have this quantity. So in particular, if I tensor with something that's non-contextual, I'm only decreasing the contextual fraction. Okay, so these are some basic monotonicity properties that we've been able to prove. I could also say something about sequential composition of models, which I didn't put on this slide yet, but essentially it works like this one. Okay. So now let's try to go towards that's operations, but now let's try to go towards saying something about how it measures advantages in tasks. So here's one example, right? This is an example from measurement-based quantum computing. So you can define any particular kind of measurement-based quantum computing. So basically we have M input bits, L output bits. So I presume most people kind of have the idea in their minds of measurement-based quantum computing. I'm going to think of there being a classical control computer, which is allowed to call out to a resource. So this could be an empirical model, quantum or otherwise. And that sends back, so it calls out, telling it which measurements to make, and it sends back measurement outcomes. All right. So the kind of computer I'm going to consider here is going to have classical control, which can only do Z2 linear computations. All right, so it's a very basic, very restricted kind of MBQC. So the classical control computer can do some pre-processing on whatever inputs I give it. It can determine the flow of measurements, so decide which measurement is going to be performed next, and so on. And it post-processes, if we like, it post-processes the outcomes in order to give its final output. So this thing can only do Z2 linear computations. If we end up computing a nonlinear function, it must be that the power to compute nonlinearity resides in these resource empirical models. Okay, so this is okay. It's a very basic toy scenario, but it's one in which we can say something interesting. So this is a result from Robert Rausendorf, which says that if an MBQC of this kind deterministically computes a nonlinear Boolean function, then the resource is necessarily strongly contextual. All right, so I can only do this if I've got a strongly contextual resource over here. And it goes a little further, and it says that if it computes the function with a sufficiently bounded error, then the resource is contextual. Okay, so that's a situation where contextuality is concretely related to some kind of advantage.
What's a Z2 linear computation?
So it's only allowed to compute. It's given m input bits, and it's allowed to compute do linear Z2 linear computations on these.
Parity,
if you like. Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. All right. So now I'm going to say how contextual fraction can kind of sharpen this sort of result. So the task here is to compute a particular Boolean function. So we'd like to compute a nonlinear one, especially. But the task is to compute some Boolean function. And we can actually measure how hard the problem is by trying to quantify first how nonlinear this function is. Okay, so this is a way of quantifying how nonlinear it is. Basically, it's a way of getting the sort of average distance between the function we're looking at and the closest Z2 linear function. The precise definition is here if you need it, if you're very curious. All right. So what we end up being able to show is that the average probability of success for computing F, it relates to the hardness of the function and to the degree of contextuality that's available to us. So we get a nice relationship that's summed up here in this inequality. Of course, I could also put this in terms of probability of failure and the contextual fraction instead of non-contextual fraction. But point is, we have this nice relationship between the three things. Okay, so this is one way in which we get advantage. Here is another one. Again, it's a fairly simple toy example, I suppose, but one in which we can already do something. So we can think about games which are described by formulae. So in particular, we have n formulae, one for each allowed input. And so the formulae are specifying for us what the winning condition for the outputs is. Okay, so this is really a way of generalizing non-local games, for instance. All right, now, if the formulae, so again, we're trying to measure the hardness of the task. So if the formulae are k consistent, which is to say that at most k of them can be satisfied at once or jointly satisfiable, then we measure the hardness of the task by basically how many must be unsatisfied, the fraction of them that must be unsatisfied. This does relate to a paper from Samson and Lucien, which I refer you to for more details on this notion of k-consistency. But again, we're able to prove this nice relationship between the degree of contextuality that's available to us, the probability of succeeding in this game, and the hardness of the game. So similar to what we had before. So here is a second example where we're actually able to relate the contextual fraction to something useful. All right. Let's move on. So there are lots of interesting ways to move with this. So I'm going to, on this slide, try to mention a bunch of them. First thing that is nice to think about is how this relates to other measures. So other measures have been proposed. For example, there's one based on negative probabilities, which has appeared in a bunch of places. It was in the paper of Abramsky and Brandenburg. It's also appeared in the literature on communication complexity, where it gives a bound on communication, can be used to derive a bound on communication complexity. And it's a different way of trying to decompose empirical models. So it's a different relaxation of this idea that we just get convex combinations of global assignments. This one says that I want to write the empirical data that I have as a... So I have two non-contextual models, E1 and E2. And I'm going to subtract, so there's a subtraction going on here, so epsilon is greater than zero. All right. And so I can always decompose no signaling empirical data in this way. And one measure of contextuality is how much negative probability I need to give to global assignments in order to recover the data that I have. So epsilon measures that for us. All right, so if you like, E1 is just a collection of, so it's going to give me one distribution over global assignments. And here with E2, I have another distribution over global assignments. One is positive and one is negative. All right, so I can always write no signaling data in this way, which is a non-trivial result, by the way. So I would refer you to, for instance, Abramsky and Brandenburger for that. All right. So in this case, we also, if we look at, so we can implement this with a linear program, we can look at dual linear program, and we get corresponding inequalities here, which are slightly different to what I talked to you about before. In particular, we have this modulus around the Bell quantity. So it's less general, but also interesting, so particularly because the people who work on communication complexity have been able to use this to get some bounds there. So one thing that we have been able to show is that the contextual fraction and the negative probability measure actually agree on cyclic measurement scenarios. So these are measurement scenarios that just look like cycle graphs. Okay. But there are a bunch of other ones. So negative probabilities is one. There are also entropy measures, which have appeared and even been considered in relation to resource theories for contextuality. And then maybe other things that could be considered. Multipartiteness width is something that's been discussed in work by Simon Perdri, Mehdi Mala, and others recently. So the relationships would be nice to nail down, and it could be that some of these also satisfy nice monotonicity properties and are maybe more tailored to quantifying advantages in particular tasks. All right, another way that this work could be extended is to signaling models, and this is something that we've also thought quite a bit about. The simple fact of the matter is that if you give me a set of empirical data that you've obtained in the lab, it's not going to perfectly satisfy no signaling. So that's one reason why you might want to consider signaling data. So really what we'd like to be able to do is to quantify the amount of no signaling and the amount of contextuality. So somehow I'd like to be able to filter out how much is of my inequality violation is genuinely a violation due to contextuality, and how much is just signaling getting you over the line. So this is actually not an easy question. The difficulty comes in the uniqueness of the decomposition. So particularly if you want to use linear programs, you don't get unique solutions. So you get unique maxima, but the decompositions aren't unique. So there's some technicalities here, which are non-trivial. Indeed, it also has some connections with the kinds of measures that are used in the contextuality by default approach. So there are probably some interesting things to be said there too. And finally, the resource theory is something that can also be further considered. So, I mean, some obvious questions are about sequencing empirical models. So we have some very initial thoughts about this. Really, we'd like to be able to say things about notions of causality if we start plugging these empirical models together. Also, I'll draw your attention to a related work that appeared recently on non-contextual wirings from Barbara and Adan, who are here, and also Marcelo and Leandro. And so this is another way of considering sort of a sequencing of empirical models. And it does have nice monotonicity. Monotonicity does hold for these operations. All right. And then, of course, the obvious question is, what else is the resource useful for? And there's much to be done there. All right. So just to recap about the contextual fraction. So I hope to have impressed on you that this is a very general way of measuring contextuality. So really, I can apply it in any measurement scenario. It's normalized, which is a good thing, because it means I can compare the degree of contextuality across different scenarios. It's nice in the sense that it goes between 0 and 1, with 0 being non-contextuality and 1 being strong contextuality. So it gives us this grading between the qualitative versions of contextuality that Samson spoke about. We have this precise relationship to violations of Bell inequalities. And in particular, we can efficiently compute both the contextual fraction and the inequality. So I think this is quite a nice point. So if you give me a set of empirical data, I can compute for you the contextual fraction, which is the maximum extent to which you can violate any contextuality witnessing inequality. And I can also find for you an inequality which attains that. Okay, what else does it have? Well, we have some computational tools which are useful for computational explorations about the degree of contextuality in different families of resources. And we have this basic resource theory. So we have a whole set of operations which are free in this resource theory, things that don't introduce contextuality. And importantly, we've also been able to show, albeit in some basic scenarios, how the contextual fraction measures quantifiable advantages. All right, and so at this point, I'm going to draw to a close, and thank you for your attention.
Time for questions.
And you said you can compute the 0.4 for Bell inequality. I thought you that Bell inequality is going to be a tied Bell inequality.
Yes.
But I'm curious about it, because imagine, in a sense, the contextual fraction is an extension of what's called the non-local fraction.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah?
So imagine I start with a scenario which is a chain Bell inequality, which is a typical scenario in which you use to get the non-local content. The funny thing is that the chain Bell inequality is not tight as a Bell inequality. However, and that's where the fun comes, it is tight. It's a non-contextuality inequality. So I was wondering whether you actually get a tight Bell inequality or a tight non-contextuality inequality. For instance, in this particular case, would you get as a solution
a chain? So I'm not sure I get the distinction. I mean, I can tell you this is definitely a tight Bell inequality in the sense that I'm defining. So what I'm calling Bell inequality is a generalized notion of Bell inequality, which applies in any measurement scenario, whether that's
a
Bell type one or a contextual one.
It's not a trace of the polygon. It's not a sampling.
I see.
I think what he's calling a problem in politics is what you're calling an intellectual
difficulty. Okay, okay. That's what my
This is certainly
is
true, yes.
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 Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Other questions?
Can you repeat what you said about signaling models? Yes. Yes, so let me go back. All right, so...
Can we quantify amount of no signaling?
Oh, right, yes, that's a... excuse me, this is obviously a typo, yes. Obviously a typo. So yeah, the idea is, given a set of empirical data, particularly if it comes from a laboratory experiment, I don't expect it to satisfy no signaling perfectly. So I want some way to look at this data and to try to quantify how much signaling is present, and ideally to filter out the signaling, so then I can ask how much contextuality is left over. So how much genuine contextuality is there? That's
and
not
and
just signaling.
Just a bell for you. Means not
textuality.
You're noticing that you're doing compatibility of your measurements, so you're sort of
Right. So yes, I have a tendency to use Bell inequality and to use no signaling in the more general sense than maybe some people are used to using them. Yes. So yes, really, what I mean here is compatibility of marginals, maybe what some people would like to call no disturbance.
Of course, the Bell inequalities are a special case. So
right.
So we. Tests.
Yes, I mean, of course, this is equally valid for Bell tests. Actually, we did some analysis on the so-called loophole-free Bell tests, which appeared at the end of 2015. I think we started decomposing the data in this way. Ultimately, because we had, you know, these choices about what the best way of decomposing, what the best order of decomposing the data was, we didn't. Go further with this, but it's certainly something that we have been intending to come back to.
Have you published all that?
No. I mean, we spoke about it in some talks, but because of these issues, we never really got to a final form where we wanted to put it out.
So one question, so this fraction, many think about it as just this maximal probability of having a predetermined box in the complex combination, like fully predetermined, right?
So maybe let me go back.
Well, mixture of fully predetermined states.
Mixture of fully predetermined. I guess you could phrase it that way. Let me come back. Here, so I guess this is the definition. So you're asking if I'm trying to maximize the weight that I can give to a non-contextual empirical model, which, yes, is going to be a mixture of these deterministic global assignments.
So you maximize the fraction at the non-contextual object, right?
Yes.
It may be mixed. I'm saying it may be a mixture.
Right, yes. That's true, yes.
I think such a thing was already defined and calculated for one example.
So for
in 2013, I guess.
Okay.
But not for Bell actually.
Oh really?
And,
okay.
And here is my question. So which type of Bell you? Because I kind of missed the point. Which type of Bell it is working for?
Which type of
Bell inequalities? Because Bell inequalities, you said it's. Because I just missed actually the final conclusion of the discussion.
Okay.
Right. So chain is something that is not on the facet. There are Bell inequalities that are on the facet of no signal, right? And this is a fundamental difference. So my question is there this difference? Can you explain this or rephrase this difference in this picture?
So I don't have a good understanding of what you guys are talking about with these chained.
Okay, so I'm saying like this. You have this no signaling polytop, right?
Yes.
So the there is Bell inequality based on Mermin, which actually touches the boundary.
Yes.
While chain is the thing that never touches, but this kind of approaches with the, you know, more and more settings.
I see. So I'm certainly getting a tight Bell inequality. So where is the proposition? I do not recall. Okay. I should know my slides better. Here, I guess this is the proposition. So I do get a Bell inequality. So what I'm calling a Bell inequality is, if you like, perhaps this is what you know as a contextuality inequality, right? So
well,
I'm talking a generalized notion.
Saying about Bell inequality, that they really have two parties, and they have this, commutativity with respect.
Sure. So if the measurement scenario is a Bell scenario, then the inequality is going to be a Bell inequality in the usual sense, and it is going to be tight. I mean, this is a result that's proved, so I'm quite confident of this.
In what sense?
In the sense that it's a theorem. But I'm
saturated.
The Bell inequality, right. So you can saturate the bound given by that Bell inequality with the non-contextual model that's going to be in this decomposition.
Or see, so this is something. Did you ask for the gap? Okay, let's discuss it later. Thank you.
You have these three-dimensional plots. You slide back out with measurements.
Three-dimensional plot. So back.
Yes, these.
Oh, plots. Yes. Yeah.
Do you have any kind of explanation for why it looks like that? I mean, they look kind of obviously periodic. Anything?
So, I mean, it makes sense that along the diagonal we should have non-contextuality, because basically I'm allowing two measurements to each party, which are the same in that case. So it's essentially I just have one measurement per party. Kind of makes sense that it should be non-contextual here. I'm not sure I have a very good explanation for the shape otherwise. What we observed with this is that we get strong contextuality from a bunch of different measurement combinations. So not just from, there are obviously arguments for strong contextuality on GHZ end states that are very well known, just generalizations of the usual Merman argument. But you can find whole other sets of measurements, and using these kinds of explorations, we were able to, from looking at the plots, we were able to conjecture what those were, and then afterwards prove that they always gave strong contextuality, for instance. But deeper than that on the shape, I can't say.
So is zero along those anti-panicles, which would presumably correspond to orthogonal pair of measurements?
Yes.
That's like the Clifford example where you don't have Bell.
That may be the case here. It doesn't look like it's the case here. I could get up these graphs and flip them around. Maybe it'd be more apparent. But it seems like it's not the case here.
Any more questions? Well, let's thank Shane.